Hi, can you slate your name, please?
This is Deborah Ann Wohl. I am 5'10" and I am based in Los Angeles.
Hi, welcome to Slate Your Name, the podcast where actors and creators share true Hollywood stories and talk about the highs and lows of working in the entertainment industry. I'm your host, Michael McMillan, and welcome back, Slaters. We have officially returned. I'm so excited to get back down to biz with you all. I spent my summer hiatus auditioning, working on my other podcast, Bigfoot Collectors Club, writing a screenplay that may or may not ever get made, and visiting Walt Disney World. I took a vacation, and that was shortly before a hurricane started ravaging Florida. I hope all of my Florida listeners and everyone else on the East Coast are safe. I want to welcome any new listeners who joined us over the break, including our new patrons, Marina Jordan Svitschirna. Hope I pronounced that right. Could have butchered that one. Karen Kirk, and Thomas McNabb. Thank you for becoming patrons of the arts. The four of them joined our Patreon, Slate Your Name, The Green Room, over the summer, and I truly appreciate your support. The podcast is free to download, but it costs money to make. If you want to support production of the show, that's what we call just a roll with it. You know what I mean? Just keep going. If you want to support production of the show for a $5 monthly pledge, you can unlock weekly bonus episodes as my thanks to you. Please visit patreon.com/slateyourname for more information. All right, let's get back down to the whole reason we're here. Our guest this week is an actress from True Blood, Daredevil, and The Punisher. She currently co-hosts the official True Blood retrospective podcast, Truest Blood, which you can hear on HBO Max or the podcast app of your choice, the one you're using right now, for example. Please welcome to the stage my dear friend, Deborah Ann Wohl. Deborah Ann Wohl, welcome to Slate Your Name.
Hi.
It's so good to have you here.
I'm so excited to be here.
We're trading podcasts this summer.
We are.
I'm very excited. How you entered the podcast world in,
I guess,
2021? Or was it early 2022?
No, I think 2021. Mm-hmm. But it was towards the end of 2021, we started working on the Truest Blood podcast, which you are now a proud guest
of. Yes, yes.
As we've been doing season
dropping
two.
Dropping soon, I guess. Do you know what episode I'll be on?
I think you are episode 8. I think that's 208.
Perfect. If that lines up with episode 8 of season 2, that's a big
Newland
episode.
Exactly. I think that was our plan. I over plan and schedule these things.
It's great. People end up loving it when it all lines up the way it should. How's it been going back and watching? You know, you've been asking all the questions to all the cast and crew. How's it been for you going back now, 10 years later, roughly, and watching not only True Blood again, but watching your work?
Yes, it's horrifying. It's it's truly horrifying. One of the things Kristen and I, my co-host on the show, talk about a lot is that she and I didn't watch when it was out. And I make it a policy of mine is never to watch my own work. So this is the first time I'm,
You never saw the show?
No.
I didn't know this.
You did not know this?
No.
Oh, we're close enough friends. I feel like we would have shared this.
If you had told me back then, I must have forgotten. But
okay.
Okay, go on. So great. Okay.
So I don't ever watch my work. So this is a real new experience for me doing this. And it has all the normal pitfalls that you would expect. None of us like to, watch ourselves or hear our own voices or things like that. That's a normal aversion. But as an actor, I just always found that watching my work made me a worse actor. Like, I think there are people who can separate enough and they can watch it like, I don't know, like a basketball player could watch their own stuff and like, learned, you know, to have a better layup or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, looking at techniques specifically.
Yeah, yeah. I am not capable of that. It just makes me defensive. It just means that the next time I'm on set and I'm starting to work, all I can think about is, oh, don't you touch, oh, you touched your hair again, or, oh, that's that weird way you say that, or, you know. And so I get very self-conscious, which of course is the, you know, the antithesis of good acting. So yeah, so it's better for me if I just go, look, my job is the acting part. And at the end of the day, I go home and I'm done.
Are you able to gracefully look at your younger self and go, okay, this is a different person. This was 10 years ago. This is already done. I can kind of give myself some space.
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, I, you know, there's the two parts of it. There's the ego part and and then the like, oh, I'm making a podcast part. And so I am sort of able to do both, I think. And I can look at it and say, oh, for the storyline, for where I was in my process and as an artist, I can give myself a little bit of grace. But there are definitely those days where I watch things and I'll go home and kind of go, God, I feel like I'm the middle school theater student acting with a bunch of professionals. And like, why did they let me stay? You know? And then, but I have had a couple of moments where I was like, oh, that was good. Like, wow, great. Deb, that was cool. And great. And I haven't ever been capable of that before. So I'm hoping that's wiser, older Deb being able to appreciate.
I think I remember the moment when everyone on the show knew you were a star.
Well,
I remember.
It hasn't happened yet. So.
Well, you are, as far as all of us who are on that show are concerned.
Aww.
I remember it was, I think it was, it's either the second or third episode of season two. You've watched it recently.
Yeah.
When does Jessica go on her first date with Hoyt?
It's episode 203 at Merlot's. So yes. That is a lovely scene.
That moment.
Yeah.
And not that we all weren't Deborah Ann Woll or Jessica fans, but that moment when you walk into Merlot's and sit down with him in that scene, I think everyone watching collectively went, oh, well, Deborah Ann Woll, star.
Oh, well, that was like
one of those scenes that were like for me, I remember it like evoked the Last Picture Show. Like you were from, oh gosh, what's now Cybill Shepherd. Like you,
right,
like there
right,
was this
right,
like
right, right.
classic movie star quality
well,
by your performance in that scene.
That's an important thing to say, though, is that like with all of the acting work and you put your heart into it and you do everything you can. And there are scenes where I am so incredibly proud of the work that I did. And I know that I found something unique. Now, that walk into Merlot's, that's not to say that like that was bad acting or anything like that. But it was lit perfectly. It was, you know, the writing set it up and teed it off. The dress I was in, the makeup, the way they did my hair, you know, it... that moment was sort of orchestrated to support that. And that, you know, there are plenty of people who, despite all that support, might still have dropped the ball and it might not have paid off.
Yeah,
so I'll give myself some credit
yeah.
in there. But, you know, but I do think that's an important thing to remember, that you can be doing spectacular work and it may never become an iconic moment.
Okay,
like that.
But Deb, that at the end of the day, all that lighting, all that makeup, all that orchestration, all the script, it's all about your moment. Yeah.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
And yes, we can argue. I think this is actually a really cool debate.
Yeah.
About like some actors don't get those iconic moments. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was a moment that I think showcased you as an actor that just went, okay, she's arrived, she's here. And I know for a fact, and this may not have been articulated ever in the writer's room, and I obviously wasn't in the writer's room, but I guarantee you it was that scene where everyone unconsciously went, well, we got to keep Jessica. We can't kill her, because I think everyone like Hoyt, you know, that's also the other moments. Mm-hmm. The purpose of the moment is that we all fall in love with you in the moment that Hoyt does, right? Mm-hmm. And Jessica, up to that point, is sort of this rebellious, annoying teenager. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I really think that's where, I also think that's the moment where the writers started to go, oh, this is who Deborah is. This is the quality.
I agree with that.
And they brought, I think that's, because this is the thing, I think that's also the moment, as orchestrated as was, that they brought Deborah Ann Woll into the role of Jessica.
Agreed. So I have very little in common with Jessica Hamby. You know, I was never a rebellious teenager. I wasn't raised particularly sheltered either. I am not as impulsive as she is. I am a strange, brainy kind of...
You're a weirdo. You're a weirdo.
I'm a dork. I'm very dorky.
Like everybody else on True Blood, you're a closet weirdo.
Yeah.
Everyone on that cast is a weirdo.
So I think the early iterations of Jessica and what they were playing with, I was trying my best, you know, and trying to kind of lean into those aspects of myself. But I agree with you. I think around episode 2 and 3, those things settled a little bit more. Or they allowed space for me to be present, I think, which just also means, I think, better acting and definitely allowed the writers to see more of what I was capable of. So I do think that they, again, the genius of Alan Ball and the writers on that show is that they saw that, and instead of feeling threatened by it or like, oh, no, we cast the wrong person, they went, fantastic, let's write to their strengths, you know, and it allowed us too, as actors, as we went on, to go, oh, well, I know that Rael's strength is writing romance. So I know that in her episodes, that I should lean into those moments, or that Bucky, it's the comedy and I can lean into those moments. So it was that really nice reciprocal relationship where we could highlight the strengths of the writers and they could highlight the strengths of the actors.
Also, you had the gift of being a character who was a pure creation of the show.
I did.
Was never in the books, which I think
was not beholden to.
was rare, novels. But I think that gave, I also think that gave the writers, especially Alan, who we know, you know, I mean, I think there's echoes of Claire Fisher from 6 Feet Under in Jessica.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So I think like Alan obviously can write in the strong voice of that point of view of the of the teenage girl. And I think that's another thing where the writers were like, there was extra care for Jessica because you were their baby. You know what I mean?
I hope so. I mean, I hope that that's how they felt about it. I also, you know, the blessing and the curse of being a dorky, nerdy, like don't want to ruffle any feathers person is that you're not very squeaky, as a, you know, squeaky wheels get oil. So, you know, the blessing of that is that everyone's always really excited to write for you and what you're going to bring, and they really enjoy working with you. But the downside of that is sometimes you don't quite get as much support or attention because they go, she's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. You're the grade A student that no one's worried about.
Sort of. I mean, I don't know about grade A, but certainly like we'll go home and figure it out on her own.
Right.
Doesn't need us to like step in and offer resources.
Yeah. You know? Well, I think that's a perfect segue because the thing that's always impressed me about you is that you are an actor. Do you prefer actor or actress?
I'm good with either.
Yeah. It's a question that sometimes comes up on the show, but
No, I know some people have very strong feelings about it, and I respect those. For me, it doesn't really.
So I tend to say actor just because I think that like, you know, that's, we're all actors. We're all doing that. I don't care that hard about it.
The only one I don't like is female actor. That's
female actor.
That really kind of
she actor.
Schachter.
Schachter. There it is. So as a Schachter,
yes.
You really do your work.
Yeah.
You are a serious, I think you and I both had this in common. It's rare being on a TV set where you feel like, oh, this person is scoring their text possibly, or doing the text work, or really looking at it from a very, from a classical, I feel like, point of view, you know.
Potentially. I do think in film and television, because presence does so much for you in film and TV, if you are a very naturally charismatic person with a very strong presence, you may not have to do as much work to kind of have the same impact. And especially if you are well cast, and it sort of fits in with your world point of view, then, you know, you really could just slide in and do very little. Then, of course, there are actors who are incredible improvisation, you know, artists, and can, you know, in the moment, their gut instincts are really clear and really specific. That is not me either. So I'm not a big personality. I'm not someone who's going to blow you off your feet when you meet me. And I don't have particularly strong improvisational skills. What I love is playing make-believe and creating imaginative worlds and relationships for myself. And for me, in order for those to feel real and natural, it requires a lot of time and thought. And it's less structured than I think some people think. I call it constructive daydreaming.
Okay, great. Let's go down.
Yeah.
Lead me down that a little bit. Down that
so
path.
So my feeling is, and again, this is everyone has different processes, but I have always found it's easier, it's more helpful for me to change everything around me and look at other people and the things in the room and have very specific ideas about all of them than it is to try to change me. If I try to change me, it feels manipulative. It feels like I'm like trying to do something.
Right.
Whereas if I look at you and I go, okay, you're older, you've been working for longer, you're
older, first
more attractive, you're more
okay, thanks.
You're more confident, you are all of these things that are more than me, I start to feel less than. Rather than trying to play less than, I look at you and pretend you're more than. And I just spend hours thinking about how much more and better you are. And then that changes me. So instead of pretending to be afraid, I create the monster.
Right.
So, and then the monster scares me in the moment because I'm an open, accessible, responsible person.
Right.
So that to me is my work.
Yeah. It sounds like you're building that imaginative world to react to.
Exactly. So, and the fact is like Steve and Bill, who is my father on True Blood, my maker on True Blood, you know, Steve is one person and he is very different than Bill. So I have to kind of, I go home and I have pictures of Steve and I have pictures of Bill and I create ideas and relationships about him based on, you know, the script and based on, you know, just created ideas that then if I start to feel a little flutter in my gut, I know I'm onto something. And then I'll go further and further down that path. So for me, breaking a script down is much more about finding the targets. So the book that I love that's the closest that's ever come to my process is Declan Donnellan's Actor and the Target.
Great.
So I recommend that book to actors out there.
What is a target exactly for people listening?
So the target is all these things. It's people, concepts, things like if there's a letter in the scene, a prop, right, that has some meaning to you, but you have to assign the meaning to it, the relationship to it. So it would be sitting for hours, maybe writing down some notes, but just constructively daydreaming about what does that letter mean? What's inside? What do I think it's going to say? Is it going to be handwritten? Is it going to be typed? How's my life going to change when I open it? That stamp, is that from yesterday or is that from 3 weeks ago? Like, when did this get sent? You know, is the paper, all those things, right? You start to kind of just create a really strong relationship to these things, these people, these ideas. Then when they call action, I don't actually have to do anything.
Right.
Because it's now just living. And I have these really strong ideas and connections to all these things around me. And they do all the work. Right. Steve Newlin, as my scene partner, does all the work for me.
Oh, boy. He's working hard.
You know? And I never then have to worry between action and cut. Which is, again, why I don't watch myself, because I just don't want to be thinking about anything other than being present and looking at Steve Newlin and going, what does he want? Like, that's another thing for me. A lot of actors work with, like, motivation. Like, what do I want in this scene? Again, it's more helpful for me to go, what do I think Steve Newlin wants, and am I going to give it to him?
Yeah, and I feel like, yeah, I great, yeah. And I think that has, I have a lot of thoughts in my head right now, but I think that
sorry, nerdy Deb was just like process. Oh my
no,
god!
No, this is what this is where I really like to go.
Good,
because I feel like that's more the thing that I always had a little bit of an issue with, not issue with, because I think it's all there. So in text, you know, I'm a very text based person, but I think I also do a little bit of what you do, but you know. When you're breaking down a text, the way that I was brought up, it was you have your victory, your obstacle, your tactic, and your expectation. The victory or goal, sometimes it's goal, is what do I want? What do I want in this scene? The obstacle is what's in my way of getting what I want. Tactic or tactics are what are the different tactics I'm going to use to overcome that obstacle to get my victory.
Right.
And then expectation is once I get that victory, what does that mean for me? You know what I mean? So if I get past the leprechaun to get to the pot of gold, I can then do what with the pot of gold? You know, how does it change my life or whatever? And it's tough because sometimes I feel like as people going around the world, we don't always know what we want.
Yes.
You know, we're often reacting to those wants often, I think, are subconscious.
Yes, I agree.
And so we have to get to a point where, and it took me a long time to learn this, to go, okay, well, the character doesn't necessarily know what they want, but I, as the objective observer or ultimately subjective observer, but you try to remain objective, you don't want to judge these people. You kind of have to figure out as an actor what it is that they want. And I do think that oftentimes the way you figure that out is in the text or in the scene. How they react to what the other characters are giving them and want from them tells you what's really going on inside.
I think so. I mean, to me, again, and it just has to do with what's helpful, right? I mean, that's all acting processes, as far as I'm concerned, are good and on the table. Even if you fake your way through every moment, what do I care? If you're having fun and you're creating entertainment and, you know, do whatever works, right?
If you get results, who cares?
One, and if you're having fun, right?
Yeah,
if it's
also,
the end of the day.
And not hurting other people.
And not hurting other people. All of those things.
Or like, projecting your method to the point where people are uncomfortable. You have to remember this is a communal, it's a collaboration.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, I don't judge people who are like, I just phone it in. As long as you are happy and it's working, you're great. You're solid in my book. But yes, you know, for me, it is just more helpful to kind of keep it in this imaginative kind of perfume in the air that I just sort of breathe in and take in and let myself just be, like they talk about the Ionian harp was sort of an old in acting school thing they talk about. The Ionian harp is this harp that's placed up at the top of the mountain and the wind plays it. So music comes out of it, but it is played by the wind. And the idea being that you are the harp. So you are a responsive, vibrating creature. And the energy of the world plays you. And so I like that idea in a scene that I'm kind of in this documentary where I just kind of take whatever is around me in. But when it comes to sort of deeper motivations and things that are going on, one, you have a lot of that in you already, just from your own life. But also I have found that the things that we present most clearly in our lives are often the exact opposite of our deepest fears. So, you know, like I'm a very nice person. I am a people pleaser at the core. But that's because of my past experiences. I have this very, very deep fear that I am an unlikable human being.
Wow.
So it's people, you know, when I tell them that I was badly bullied and that I have this fear of being unlikable, they're like, how could you feel that way? You're such a nice person. But I am partially a nice person because I am terrified that at my core, there's something wrong with me.
You're saying, don't come after me. I'm fine. Nothing to see here.
Nothing
I'm
to
not
see
a threat.
Here.
I'm not a threat.
I'm not in any way a threat. And I don't want you to see the unlikable truth of me. So I'm gonna put all of my effort and energy into being the opposite of that. And, you know, I think we see that, like people who are afraid of being alone spend their time with all sorts of people and might be called extroverts and party people and you know, love to spend time with people. And I would argue some of that is because they don't really know or are afraid to not be around people. So yeah. I think that's a great way to mine your character and kind of, you know, look and see like what the things that they appear to want might actually be like the converse of their fear, which drives, unfortunately, so much of human instinct.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, this is why I like this work, because it really does, once you start to dig into this stuff, it really ultimately becomes larger conversations yeah. about people mm-hmm. and about human nature and human desire. And that's, I mean, in a show like True Blood, you know, that's a fun window into those deeper things, yeah. you know, which we talked a little bit about on your upcoming episode, but, well, you know, what's really underneath yeah. the desire, you know,
yeah.
in relationships and what people want and what secrets are people holding. That's the other thing that I also love to carry with me is what secret does this character have, you know,
right.
what secret, what part does nobody know about yeah. them, you know?
Well, and that's the fun thing for me, right? Like, great writing is great, but that's the writer's job, right? Like, my job is everything I don't get to say. Mm-hmm. So there's so much fun. I mean, what my character, what I personally am thinking and feeling and then don't get to express is, you know, the iceberg below the surface of what I actually get to say. And good writing right. knows that, you know, good writing is not literal. You know, that's really the fun of it, is that every scene is 10% of, if that, of the work that has been done for it.
It's great. And then if you're in a series or on a series that goes and you're lucky enough to be part of it, mm-hmm. maybe some of those other aspects will come out over time.
Maybe.
That was the only,
most of
not
the time
always.
They don't, you
yeah.
know, you know, 90%
nice
is a lot.
It's nice to have that under there yeah. because especially when you have to sustain a character for that long.
Yeah.
So I think this is really cool because you've obviously done projects like True Blood and then mm-hmm. over in the Marvel universe
yeah.
of being in these big imaginative worlds that require the use
sure.
of, so how do you go,
I mean,
from
Daredevil,
you know,
was significantly more our world than
yes.
True Blood was.
Sure. Yeah, no,
but
that's
why
true.
True Blood was such a great training ground.
But they're still like still in the outer world, and maybe you didn't have to do this on Daredevil.
No,
or
Daredevil
or
was just defending the crap out of 10 blocks of Manhattan.
Right, right.
It.
But still, you, there has to be a part in your mind,
yeah.
I'm guessing, where like Karen Page is like, but also out there, there are Asgardian gods.
We know that there are aliens.
You know what I mean?
There, and, yeah.
That's the thing that's always fascinated me about playing real world, non-superpowered characters uh-huh. and stuff like them, which I haven't gotten to do, but is but as a comic book reader too, it's like, what do these people think on their day-to-day life when they're like, oh yeah, and there are scrolls out there that can shapeshift
right,
and look
right.
like people. So
right.
there had to be, was there any of that stuff where you're like,
I honestly didn't invite that in too much to the mm-hmm. Daredevil space, mostly because we were such a like boots on the ground kind of show. And, you know, our villains were corrupt, you know,
politicians
and development, you know, you know, our villains were not necessarily, you know, even the Punisher was, he doesn't have any superpowers. Electro
no.
doesn't have any superpowers, you know, so, you know, the people that we had on our shows were not, extraordinary
right.
superpowered people. So we kept it pretty boots on the ground. But I think one thing within these big worlds to always remember is that you could go a number of different ways. You could either say like, oh, well, there's so much supernatural stuff going on, nothing is a surprise anymore. Or everything is a
yeah.
giant, huge, like, revelation. Now
yeah.
there's this kind of
oh,
thing.
Oh, great. Now there's,
you know,
space gods. Great.
Right. So,
yeah.
you know, I think you kind of try to figure out what works for maybe your character's perspective and go that way. I think Karen Page is a kind of take it in stride, like, all right, another thing I got to deal with. So
right.
it didn't really serve me to see the world as being constantly bigger than her in that way.
Right. Well, I think that also what you're speaking to there is coping mechanisms. And I think in a world where that stuff might go down, you're like, listen, all I can focus on are these 10 blocks of New York City.
I'm going to fix this.
I don't have any say on what Captain America is doing. Yep. I have to, this is the only, and that to me feels almost, that's the most honest, actually.
And doesn't that feel really human? I mean, every day we have to deal with things that are, you know, our planet is dying.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
I can put my plastic bottle in the recycling bin.
Yeah.
You know,
that's all I can do.
I cannot buy a new car, you know, like
and these big problems that you feel like, yeah, I can vote, I can do all this, and that's what I can do. Yeah. I can volunteer, whatever,
yeah,
but I can't actually get out into the outer atmosphere and like
repair,
dilute
the ozone.
You know, the carbon
exactly,
and the, you know, it's like you're not a superhero, you know what I mean, but I love that. Yeah, it's about coping. And I think that that's the other thing is, as characters, we're constantly dealing with in scenes is like, what is this, to bring it back, what is this other people doing? What is this other person doing to me? What do they want from me? And how do I adjust and react to that?
And that's the fun is like, there's a lot of power and fun in going, oh, wait, what did that? And it keeps you present because it's literally like, what did he do with his eyebrow right there? What does he mean by that?
Yeah.
You know, like he smiled. Why would he smile when he said that? It just gives you questions, which keeps you keyed into the person you're doing your scene with, present in this moment rather than like wondering how you're doing or, you know, whether it's going to be liked by anyone, you know. And it just keeps, and then because I've created this strong relationship, you know, the little smile might make me go, oh, he likes what I said. Or it might make me go, motherfucker, can I curse on this? I don't know. Why, you know, like, he's not supposed to be happy about that. You know, like, it affects me rather than me having to somehow make myself appear affected.
Yeah.
It's just easier for me.
I love it. It's great. Yeah. A lot of hard, imaginative, maybe fun, homework at home.
Constructive daydreaming.
And then you get to work and make it easy. I love it.
Well, and I'll offer one more thing just because it's a favorite thing of mine. It's just about the only kind of, I guess, more like artsy-fartsy things that I do. There's a poem called The Song of Amergin. I think it's an old Celtic poem. And it's essentially a list of archetypes. It's, you know, I am a stag of seven tines. I am a wind on a deep lake. I am a spear that roars for blood. Things like that. These very evocative images of archetypes. And I find with every new role that I can find two or three that I'm like, fuck, that's perfect. And then I'll maybe choose one more that feels a little off and in the spirit of secret, right? Something that maybe doesn't quite suit the character, but somehow I'm drawn to. Mm-hmm. And that can be like a little secret archetype thing. But so for Jessica, I chose, I am the blaze on every hill was one of the archetypes that I chose. And then I went and I did a bunch of research on like, what does blaze mean, right? And what does, and then fire, and then all of these things that go through. And one, I remember I wrote this in all caps and highlighted it in my notebook because I got to be conspicuously bright. And because, you know, a blaze, fire is warm and safety, and it's also extraordinarily dangerous and unpredictable. And I was like, those are the things that I want to be present in Jessica. So other than going, well, how am I going to play unpredictable? I have no idea how to do that. But I can be a very conspicuous, you know, light, which is kind of cool. You know, something like those more evocative things sometimes have are easier to kind of get the vibe of than trying to play an idea.
I love it. It's beautiful. Well, let's take a conspicuous break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the roles that you've played in your career.
Yay.
Okay, we're back with Deborah Ann Wool.
Hello.
And this is a, I call it a game. It's not really a game. I guess there's okay. a guessing aspect to it. Okay. I'm going to go down your IMDb
oh boy.
List, the Internet Movie Database.
Yes.
And I'm going to pick some character names and you're going to tell me what show or project they were from.
Okay.
And then we'll talk a little bit about it. I like to go back into the early years because I guess we didn't really get into it. You were originally from Brooklyn.
Yes.
You're the rare case of a New York actor who just immediately came out to Los Angeles.
I went to USC out here for my theater school. Mm-hmm. I went to theater school.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I grew up in New York, so I was less inclined to sort of stay there another 4 years.
Yeah, that's New York was your Kansas City, which was yes. my... So funny. I would have been like, New York City, I'm never leaving. Okay, so here we go. This is called Show Me Your Name.
Okay.
Aurora Quill.
Oh,
you played Aurora. A character named Aurora Quill. This sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
It does. Do I have any idea what that was?
I'll give you some hints. This was in 2008.
Oh, is this ER?
Yes. Okay. This is ER.
One episode of ER. Yes.
Yep. Yep. This is an early guest star role that you got. Uh-huh. Do you remember what Aurora, was she there? Was she sick? Was she visiting
no,
someone in the
I was
hospital?
A nurse.
Oh.
There was I did a lot of like single episodes with like the possibility to recur kind of thing,
okay.
you know, in the beginning of my career. So yeah, just a nurse. They had a new series regular on, I think, that year, a new guy. And his whole thing was that he was a bit of a Lothario that would flirt with all of the young nurses and stuff. So basically, I think I did some featured background work of like inserting IVs and doing that kind of stuff. And then we had a scene where he flirted with me. And that was
it John Stamos? Was that
it? Was not. No, it was a new guy. John had been on for a while at that point.
How was that being on that? That must have been one of your first like big, that's an established show. That's it must be,
I think so. I think I had
10
already
seasons
done
in by that point.
I had
15.
Already done True Blood at that point.
Oh, wow.
Because of the way things come
line
out.
Up.
Right.
Yeah.
I think I had already shot True Blood. But by the time I did this one, by the time I did ER, because I only had one or two things before I did True Blood. So I had already done the HBO Alan Ball.
So you're like, I got this.
Star thing. And this was pretty easy potatoes. I didn't have like any sort of deep work to do.
Yeah. Right. You're like, so, I imagine I'm in a hospital.
I imagine I'm a nurse. they didn't give Aurora Quill any sort of strong points of view on anything.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Greta.
Greta. Yes. My name is Earl. That was very fun. One of the few like straight comedies.
I was going to say, that's why I picked
I've
this because you're not, you don't end, although I find you funny and there are comedic moments in True Blood.
Yes. And ironically, theater where I started and my true love is I do more comedies in theater. Than I do dramas.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think,
was the same way.
Yeah, I think I am a funny person, but I'm not very good at telling jokes. So it depends what the thing is. Like I just auditioned for, or I guess I didn't end up auditioning for it. It's a TV series that was written by and for stand-up comedians, and it's going to be great. Mm-hmm. But I was reading this thing, and I was like, I don't know how to do this, right? Like, I just don't have that rhythm that, you know, so much of that is like actually determining how you're going to say the line for the comedic impact. And that is antithetical to my process. My process is say it different every time. I don't want it to ever come out the exact same way twice. Not by purposefully changing things up incredibly, but I don't even want to think about how the word comes out of my mouth.
Right.
So that makes me a bad sort of
stand-up
comedy stand-up-y kind of person.
Yeah, it's funny too because also we're in this era where on film a lot of the comedy comes from I mean, timing is everything, right?
Yeah.
I still think that's the thing. And I think that a lot of times with, obviously I'm not a stand-up comedian, but I think part of that is really about nailing the timing of a joke. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I say it this, I give it this beat, I give it, you know, it's really figuring out that timing.
And I've seen Jerry Seinfeld, you know, three times do the same material and it is exactly the same and it's perfection, you know? So again, this isn't a judgment, but knowing me and the way that I work and what makes me most present, that feels confining.
It's a lot like a song, right? Mm. It's a lot like nailing a song and knowing, okay, my breath has to be here. I have to do this. That was something I learned doing Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and then singing the song. I had a song, a solo, and the only solo I really had, which was very hard song, very high, written right on my break. But then we would go perform it live. And I was like, this is a fucking tough song. And I really, even though there were like ways to kind of like still be a little silly with it in the moment, I had to technically be like,
wow,
I have to place this note in my mouth here. If I don't, I'm going to crack, you know?
Wow.
So I feel like that must be similar.
I mean, I am not a singer, but I can sing, I suppose.
And
anytime I've ever done musical work, I very clearly am like, I am a character singer, right? Like
this is,
if it breaks, that's great.
Yeah.
Because that means something's happening to this person, right?
Yep.
Like,
yep.
So I am never going to be in the you know, standard, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein kind of stuff. But I, you know, when I'm 60, please God, I will do the Elaine Stritch part in Company, right? Like, I will do those parts.
I was going to say Sondheim, you belong in Sondheim. That's,
well, it depends.
You know,
like, late night music is going to require some, you know, pipes. But again, it depends on where the focus is, right? So I think for me, you know, the last musical I did was Three Penny Opera. And it's a hard piece.
We were
encouraged to make it character. And so for me, the songs were incredibly freeing. And there were times I just talked lines because it's Brecht. And there were times I sang them. And there were times I did a little of both. And there were times I sang it up the octave and times I sang it below the octave because I knew where my voice was, you know, whatever it was. And that was really, I found that very fun. So again, it's all of these things can be done in the many different ways, but when you can tell what someone's going for and that isn't your strength.
Right.
I could send it in and know I've wasted my time and theirs, or I could say, blessings to you.
Okay.
I am not the person for you.
Okay. But for the sake of collegiate debate here.
Yes.
I'm going to push you a little bit.
I know, and I should be pushed.
No, because here's what I would say.
I'm a chicken is really the
answer. Well, fair enough. We're all cowards, right? But using the imaginative world building that you do, I think then what you need to do is remember that, okay, the delivery here is an outward extension of me.
Mm-hmm.
Can't you then go, well, how would, I know this is how other comics do this, but
right.
If I were a stand-up and I had to do it, here's
right.
how I would do it.
Well, that's
you
the Stanislavski,
I mean?
Right? What? Right. I mean, that's the core father of theater idea. And I agree with you on that.
It's the challenge of playing characters who are also artists.
I wasn't playing a stand-up comedian. The role it was written by stand-up
really
comedians
confused.
For
really,
stand-up comedians,
okay.
but
oh,
it was
okay.
a scripted series
oh,
starring
okay.
stand-up comedians.
Okay.
So it would be
okay.
like Tool Time, you know, or you know, it was a Home Improvement,
yes,
or
yes.
you know,
Tool Time was the show within the show, thank
right?
you very much.
I don't know, well, I can't remember, or you know, or Everybody Loves Raymond, you know, like it was a scripted show, but starring stand-up comedians,
right?
So just the way it was written, I just could hear. I mean, you can't, and
you
they don't want
it.
You to, right? They don't want you to do anything except the way the joke is gonna land, you know. So I don't know. I agree. If I were playing a stand-up comedian, sure, that's another world. I can try to find my way into that.
You
but
know
I
what,
just
though?
Knew I could just read it and go, I can hear the rhythm of this in the writing. And I, not only will I not be good at it, I won't be happy doing it.
Have you ever watched the pilot of Cheers?
I have. I fucking love it.
Yeah, because I mean, I think of scripted multicam comedies mm-hmm. back then. And mm-hmm. like for me, every episode, I mean, there's some people that people could look, there's some aspects where you could look at something like Cheers and be like, well, this is just multi-camera presentational joke.
No, they played it,
obviously very well written. They played it honestly, and they played it like a play. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Shelley Long, who I feel like there are aspects of Shelley Long in you as a performer. Yeah. You know what
I
mean?
I'm proud to hear that.
Yes.
I think her performance brilliant. On the show is very brilliant and brave, frankly.
Yeah. And I don't think she's someone who would traditionally be, you know, I think she's an actor. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So I don't know. I think that there are ways. Yeah, it's got to be funny, but it doesn't matter. As long as it's funny at the end of the day, that's all that matters, right? I still think you can
sure.
put yourself
I probably should have tried for it, but I just
I'm not saying you should have or shouldn't have, but I think you can.
It was also like a cool person with like suave and swagger and like confidence. Anytime I get offered a character with confidence, I'm always like, should I even try?
I mean, there is such a thing as being miscast. Yes.
No. Should I even try to pretend that this is something I understand?
I get some of those too, where they're like, he's a guy's guy, a real man's man. I'm like, guys, give me a fuck. What are we doing here? Or they're like, he played football in college. I'm like, guys, come on. What are we doing? All right. We're running out of time. Let's do one more. We did so much for we didn't even talk about My Name Is Earl.
Okay.
Did you have fun on that project?
I did. It was really fun. I ate a lot of French fries.
Oh, great. That's a nice little. All right, let's see. I'm going to
My first experience with a spit bag.
Oh, disgusting.
Disgusting.
I've had to do that before and it was gross. I had to eat a lot of hot dogs in a thing.
Ugh,
and one of the
worse.
People was a vegetarian, one of the other actors. And yeah. they're like, can we do veggie dogs? And I was like, oh, that's probably better. And those veggie dogs tasted like Band-Aids. And I was like, oh, I would have much rather have to like eat a ton of like regular hot dogs yeah. and eat this. It was gross. All right. One last. Here we go. I'm just going to pull this one out of nowhere. Molly.
No last name.
Just Molly. It's a spooky title.
A spooky title?
Mm-hmm.
Molly. And a spooky
2011.
Title. 2011. Okay, so we're still in True Blood days.
You're in True Blood days. You're just...
Okay, is it one of those... Oh, no. I don't think that was her name. Maybe it was? And the title of the movie might have changed. Remember, I haven't seen it.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, and
is
you
this
haven't
Ghosts
watched
Ghosts of Louisiana?
Ghosts of New Orleans.
New Orleans. Okay.
Got a
it was
little
called
more
something
specific.
Else when I did it, but I don't remember what that was either.
This stars Josh Lucas, Terrence yes. Howard, and Lake Bell.
Yes. Yes, it did. I really only worked with Terrence, but I'm a little bit with Josh. I met him and met Lake, mm-hmm. but... it was a very, very quick, you know, little thing in a very hot Louisiana summer. And I think I did two other movies. Oh, no, we were not in Louisiana. We were in Detroit. We shot that in Detroit.
Wild,
right? I shot two other movies in Louisiana that did not take place in Louisiana. And then I shot the Louisiana movie.
In Detroit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, True Blood, which we would go to Louisiana.
We'd go every once
occasionally.
In a while. But it was an L.A. show. Yeah.
All L.A. Wild. All right. Well, I hope you didn't need a spit bucket on that one.
I didn't. No, I didn't have to eat anything.
Okay. Well, we have come to the end of this episode. I could talk to you. I mean, we barely got into your personal background, but I love that I love that we got into stuff about process. You
me
know
too.
What I mean? Because I always find that fascinating. I always learn something.
Actors always like to be mysterious and kind of like, you know, don't want to share that kind of thing. And I'm like, well, no. I mean, if you have to, because that's the only way it works for you, fine. But yeah. I want actors out there to know that there are so many different ways to work and to be able to like, oh, that sounded interesting. I'm going to try that next time and see if it works for me.
That also sounds to me like actors who don't know what they're doing and they don't want to admit it.
Whenever someone says I don't want to share my process, I agree. There's a little thing that goes off in the back of my mind that's like, I think that's because you don't have one.
Yeah, you don't have one. Or you haven't realized that you do have one.
Right.
It's just, you know, They're like,
and you're
I
a little bit
up.
Embarrassed.
Yeah, you're a little bit
fine.
Embarrassed.
Just so you show up. That's okay.
Deborah Ann Wohl, where can people find you? Where can people find Truest Blood? Give us all the dirty details.
So again, I'm not super great at all of this, but I believe on the socials, it's just my name, Deborah Ann Wohl, at all of the places. Truest Blood is on all the major podcast platforms, but if you have HBO Max, you can listen on there as well with some cool graphics. It'll also end up on
YouTube. Oh, that's fun. So when you do, because somebody said to me, someone had seen me repost something about it, and they were like, wait, where do I get this? HBO Max? And I was like, it is on there, but you can listen to it as a podcast.
But it's everywhere else, and it will end up on YouTube about a week after.
If you go on HBO Max, are we seeing like video from the Zoom meeting, or No.
A lot of people have asked us to do the video, but as you may know, that instantly is ridiculously more difficult.
Yeah, I know. And, trust me. I try to do it with Bigfoot Collectors Club as well, and it's just like, it's so hard.
It's instantly so much harder and so much more money and time and all that. And especially with our interviews, we edit. So editing that video down so that it's actually, it would be almost impossible.
Guys, your old pal Michael talked a long time. He went on and on and
on. But that's what we want.
You
know, like we like to ask questions from a lot of different angles so that we really start to get people down to their hearts, and that may take some time sometimes. So we're not doing video, but on HBO Max, I believe there's like, either you'll see our faces or the guest's face. There might be like a blood drip thing.
Cool.
It might be a loop of the, opening credits. There's, something, if you want something on your TV for the dogs when you go out.
Check it out. So that's everywhere you get podcasts and on HBO Max.
Yeah, every Monday, Truest Blood.
Great.
Kristen
Love
Bauer.
It. All right. Well, we're going to wrap this up, but you are going to join me in the green room.
Yes. Do
you have a little tease of what story you're going to share?
Yes.
There?
So in true Deborah fashion, when you asked me for a story, the only ones that came to mind were terrible ones.
Great.
So this is a very sad story.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, grab a box of tissues and meet us over there. Thanks, Deb.
Thanks.
Okay, everyone, you can join Deborah and me in the green room over at patreon.com/slateyourname. If you don't have $5 to spare, then how about 5 stars? Please follow, rate, and review this podcast on your favorite podcast app. If you write us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we might read it on the air, like this one from Trixie973, who writes, "Yes! OMG! I love Michael, and I love this podcast. Thank you, hands emoji, times 5. 5 stars. Well, thank you, Trixie. We're happy to have you over here. Follow us on Instagram at Slate Your Name Podcast and me at McMills. And write to us, please. I want to hear your thoughts about the show and your questions. You can write to me at slateyournamepod@gmail.com. In fact, I got a letter from that new patron, Thomas McNabb, over the summer. I'm going to read it and respond to it right now. Hi, Michael. First off, I love the content you put out with Slate Your Name and Bigfoot Collectors Club. I really enjoyed your interviews with Bryce and Allison Munn in regards to their time on What I Like About You. And that's where I first saw you back in 2003, and I kept an eye on your career, and Dorian Blues holds a personal connection to me as I saw that movie right around the time I was coming out. That's awesome, dude. And then you popped up on True Blood and were just fabulous. I loved hearing about how you came to audition for that role. You truly were perfect for it. Well, thank you. Okay, enough ego stroking. No, please, go on. I'll get to why I'm emailing. Just curious if you'll be reaching out to any of the other casts from What I Like About You to appear on Slate Your Name, especially as it's the show's 20th anniversary. Well, you know what, Thomas? I didn't even realize that, and I should have. I'm somewhat of a huge YLA fan. Go Team Henry, boo Vince. And all right, now you're just pandering to me. And my signed cast photo from season 2 is framed on my wall and one of my most valued possessions. Thanks for signing it. I have no memory of that, Thomas. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm also really curious to hear about your audition / time as Henry and how it came to be that you returned to write an episode, which, if I understand correctly, is not the episode you pitched. I think personally someone should interview you for Slate Your Name, but I hope in the future I can hear you chat with Jenny Garth or Leslie Grossman. Best wishes, Tom. All right, Tom. Well, thank you for your letter. I would love to have Jenny and Leslie on the show. I definitely think that's a possibility. I've for sure thought about reaching out to everybody else on What I Like About You. You know, True Blood can't be the only show that I pull guests from. So definitely hope to do that in the future. So stay tuned for that. Your letter gives me more encouragement to do so. As far as auditioning for Henry, you know, that was, you know what, since you're a patron, I'm going to answer those questions over in the green room. How about that? So if you guys want to hear the answer to how I got the role of Henry and then how I ended up writing an episode of the show, that will be on this week's Patreon episode over in the green room. So let's do that. Everybody else, write in if you have any other questions or comments. Even if you don't want me to read it on the air, I would love to hear your thoughts and reactions to the show. I'm so excited to be back. If you enjoyed this, you might like my other podcast, Bigfoot Collectors Club, especially appropriate for the spooky season, where we share stories of high strangeness featuring UFOs, ghosts, Sasquatch, and more. I want to thank Deborah Ann Wool one last time for being my guest and my colleague, John Forrest, for editing and engineering this episode. Thanks, John. If we don't see you in the green room, we'll meet you back here next week. Until then, don't call us. We'll call you.